At some time during the first 3 hours of Christ's crucifixion, he sadly watched the Roman soldiers cast lots or roll the dice, as it were, for his humble clothing. And as he looked down from the crucifixion detail, these hardened soldiers, that's what they did for their role in the military. This was not their first crucifixion. He looked down from them, and according to Luke chapter 23, verse 34, he said, "Father, forgive them." Why? They don't know what they're doing. They had no idea that he was the Son of God hanging on that cross for their sins. Now, I know from Matthew 26, verse 53, during the process of his interrogation by the Jews and by the Romans, Christ made the claim that if he wanted to call 12 legions of angels to his rescue, he could have done it. And that would have meant a lot to a Roman soldier because they all knew what a legion was. So a legion, scholars will debate it. I'm sure I'll get emails after church about this from the military people in our church. But from the best that I can study, a legion was around 5,600 soldiers. Could be 6,000, but best information that I can uncover is 5,600 soldiers. So if Jesus can call 12 legions composed of 5,600 soldiers, mathematicians among us have probably already crunched the numbers, or you've done it on your phone, because thinking minds want to know. How many angels could Jesus have called? No mathematicians? You're all English majors? A lot. Thank you. Yeah, a lot. 67,200 angels. That's a lot of angels. And that's not all of them. I mean, that's a fraction of them. So did he really need all those angels? No. But he said, if I really want to back up to deliver me from this trumped up trial, I totally get it. I could allow 67,200 angels to go from their dimension to ours and totally rescue me. But he didn't do that. Why? We had a mission, and the mission was to go to the cross to die for our sins. And so he wanted to fulfill that mission. But what did he do to the soldiers that were gambling away his clothes? Showing them mercy, because he didn't have to. He showed them absolute mercy. Long before Jesus acted in that unbelievable fashion, David, who would become the great type of Jesus, was placed in situations where God wanted to know from this David, who would become the type of the Messiah, are you going to act like the Messiah when he comes? And God's going to do the same thing to you. He's going to put you in situations, they're not going to be fun, where you're going to be left with a decision, am I going to act like Christ or not? Am I going to show mercy or am I going to be vengeful? What am I going to do? David's had a lot of those situations. If you want to review, he's had Saul throw a javelin at him to try to kill him while he's merely playing on his harp, playing some soothing music. Saul went crazy. What else happened? He's on, last week we saw that he's in the wilderness, Maon. He's with his 600 soldiers. They're on a mountaintop. Saul's doing a pincer movement to outflank him, the left and the right. He's about to take him out. He's constantly having these situations where God's telling David, make a choice at this crossroads how you're going to behave. You're going to retaliate, or are you going to be godly about it? Same thing with you. I've been in those situations before myself, as I'm going to talk about in the sermon. But God does the same in your life because he wants to see you grow and you mature in the faith. And so I don't know if you've ever encountered a Saul type, a mean, nasty person who has it out for you and you can't figure out why. But I can tell you how they operate because I've faced them in my life as a pastor. Usually they don't attack your argumentation, they attack you. Ad hominem attacks, personal attacks. Hard to defend yourself from people slandering your character. And one of the words in Greek for slanderous speaking, gossip speaking, is blasphemeo. Sound familiar? It's like blasphemous things they say about you. When I was a young pastor and people used to say mean things about me out in California, I was like, you got to be kidding me. I thought becoming a pastor would be less fun and easy. And that, well, no, there's goats and there's sheep and wow. So at one point, I had a list of 19 mean names they called me. And I just kept growing, like every week, something else they'd say. And you can't defend yourself. So I've been there where they attack your character. They seek to defame you, sully your good name. And really, in those kinds of people, the Saul types, no matter what you say to them, they're not reasonable. They're emotional. And you can't reason your way with them to the point where they're like, oh, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right about that. I am so sorry. That doesn't happen very often. So when you with that kind of person and you're dealing with them, and I can tell you what they do to you personally, they get you emotionally tired. They can put strain on your relationships, i.e. your marriage, if you're married. They can cause you to worry and stare at the ceiling at night. And you can be fearful that these people are going to ruin my career or something like that. I've been down all those roads, but sometimes God gives you an opportunity that presents itself out of the clear blue that you get the opportunity to deal with them or let God deal with them. What are you going to do when that opportunity presents itself? That's what's going to happen to David when he's in an area called En-Gedi. He's going to get a situation that is going to be a golden opportunity to deal with Saul. And how he behaves is otherworldly. Will you do the same? So I call his situation here the predicament. He has a predicament. It's a crossroad. What are you going to do with the situation? It says in verse 1, it came about when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told by his spies, saying, hey, we've got good intel on David. We know exactly where he is. He's in the wilderness of En-Gedi. So obviously, if you were here last week? So you remember, you know, Saul's trying to take out David on that mountain, and he gets intel that the Philistines are attacking, so he has to leave to go protect the nation. And at that precise moment when he does that, that allows David to go east down to the Dead Sea region and hike up into the wadi, the gorge of En-Gedi. The wilderness of En-Gedi. The word En-Gedi in Hebrew translates the spring of young goats. So I took my last church one time camping at a place called Bear River Reservoir. Okay? So we're setting up the tents, and one of the high school students came up to me. She's tattooed down and everything. She's like, yo, pastor, got a question. I'm like, what's up? She goes, why is it called Bear River Reservoir? Well, if it was called Squirrel River, oh! Totally see what you're saying. Do you mean that there are bears? So if in Hebrew it is called the spring of young goats, what should you expect to find here? Young goats. Goats. And trust me, I have hiked into this region many times over the last 25 years, and there are goats everywhere. There's goats in the parking lot. And I would submit to you, just for your own maturation, if you rent a car and you park in the visitor's parking lot, don't park near a tree. Because the goats, these goats, the ibex, this ibex, they will jump on top of your car's hood and then on top of the car to get to the tree to eat the goodies. They will total your rental car. That's extra. I'm just saying, I've watched it happen. So they called this the spring of young goats because there was a spring there, it was an oasis, and there were lots of goats there. An ibex. This is the trackless desert region of southern Israel. I've been out there 1,400 feet below sea level. I grew up in 800 feet below sea level near Mexicali, Mexico, out in the desert near Yuma, born and raised there. I know what muy caliente is. Been there, done that. When I first went to the En-Gedi region, I could not believe this desert. It was way beyond the desert that I grew up in because it's 1,400 feet below desert. The sea level, and there is like hardly anything there. And so David's taking his troops there to hide out from King Saul. The water in this area is most interesting. The Dead Sea, beautiful sea is, in the evening, in the mornings. It's beautiful. The water is turquoise. It's gorgeous, but it's got problems because it's a Dead Sea. So because it says Dead Sea, guess what? It's dead. You never see anybody fishing there. Why? There's no fish. Why are there no fish? Because it's 33% saltier than the ocean. So no fish can live in it. And so you're looking at the sea. So the Jordan River, the word Jordan, in Hebrew means the descent of the Dan. Because the Jordan River starts in northern Israel up in the Golan Heights at the city of Dan. So up above the city of Dan is Mount Hermon. And the snow from the mount leaches down into the ground and pops out from underground aquifers at Dan. So when you go to Dan, lush, green, it's beautiful, and there's water coming out of the ground all over the place, and it's flowing into rivers and that form the mighty Jordan River. And it descends from the heights of the Golan, 1,400 feet below sea level, down to the Dead Sea, and it terminates there with nowhere to go, and basically the water, as it were, dies there and becomes super salty. It's also a great place to swim. Have you ever swam in the Dead Sea? It is life-changing. You take, you know, you get your swimsuit on and you get down into the water and you step in and about, I don't know, about up to your knees, you're going, wow, there's a current. Mm-mm, there's no current. It's picking you up. You're buoyant. And once you get up about waist high, it's lifting you off the bottom. And so what you do is you squat down and you lean back slowly and bink, you just float. You just sit there. Everybody starts laughing. My tour groups of like linked hands together to have this kumbaya moment as we're all floating around the Dead Sea. You don't have to struggle to stay afloat. You just float. It's awesome. But you don't want to drink that water. And you definitely don't want to roll over in the water, nor do you want to shave. I've seen this happen. I tell people, don't shave, because it's 33%. If you want pain, go right ahead. I try to help people when we go here. David's in this region, can't drink the water. It's hotter than I'll get out. I mean, and it's like, let me show you some pictures of other little critters here. So I showed you the ibex. I'm going to show you a hyrax. Hyrax, picture of a little critter. You know, I was hiking up the gorge one day in Gedi, where the oasis is, and this little dude pops out of this little cave, and everybody, you know, all the men are wanting to charge up the hill, you know, to the fortress, you know, and everybody, the women are like, oh, that's so cute, and so everybody wants to stop and take pictures. So here's a picture of a hyrax, all right? Now, so you got ibex there. They're all over the place. They're goats. They can climb anywhere. These little things live in the little holes as you're walking up the gorge with the water flowing next to you. And there's plenty of food here for David because he can eat goat or he can eat a hyrax. I don't know if they taste like chicken, but they're there. There's something there to eat. And notice what the hike is like. Here's a couple other pictures. This is the tour group going up this lush green valley. Lots of shade. No. I mean, OSHA did not plan the steps hiking up this gorge. So I always tell everybody down in the visitor center, it's going to be hot. It's going to be somewhat dangerous because there's long steps, short steps. There's skinny steps, there's tall steps. I mean, there's a handrail. It's kind of rickety. Sometimes there's no handrail. And if you bite the dust, man, I hope your salvation is secure because we ain't going to retrieve you for a while. And so very dangerous hike. So we always get a few people that are, I'm just going to stay. It's God's will. Down here where the ice cream is and the sodas. Okay, these are people who believe in eternal security, heading up into the oasis waterfall area. I will show you, what's on the right hand, no, go back one. Thank you. I got God controlling my slides. Yeah, what's over there on the right hand side of the picture? Caves, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. You're David, you're like, man, we got water here. We got things to eat. This is fantastic, there's caves. Here's some more caves as you're walking along. They line the walls of the Gorge of En Gedi. Now, here's another interesting picture. What's that? Water. Water in the middle of nowhere is a good thing. You're walking along, it's hot, and you hear this water gushing down next to you. I mean, I can tell you what you want to do. Every tourist, they want to go get in it, you know? And there's pools of water, and there are people in it and enjoying it. And it's just gushing down there, and it's coming from a waterfall that drops several stories at the top of the gorge. And David's in this region. Why? There's water here and there's food here. Great place to be. And it's defensible. He's in a gorge. He can defend it well with his men. It says in verse 2, Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all of Israel, went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. Where's that? En Gedi. That's where they went. They went to En Gedi. How many soldiers does he have? 3,000. How many does David have? 600. It's a 5-to-1 ratio, right? Who's outnumbered? David is. What kind of soldiers does Saul have? What does it say that he has? Chosen. Okay? Chosen. Yeah. He has the studs of the military, the special ops guy, the guys that, yeah, they're physically fit, great warriors. Who does David have? Well, we know. Remember how he got his army? He's hiding in a cave, and all of a sudden, these guys just start showing up. Yeah, why are you here? Well, you know, my charge cards were charged up, and I lost the house. I lost the bank accounts closed. I don't have any money. That's why I'm here. Dave was like, well, you're kind of overweight. I don't think you could be a soldier, but yeah, I'm here to fight, dude. Some of them are, you know, he's like, why are you here? Hey, couldn't handle the politics of Saul anymore. No way. No way. Guy's all over the map. He's emotional. He's not logical. One day he's awesome. Next thing he's like, who is he? I don't want him as my king. Like, so I'm here. I'm here to fight. You ever fought before? No, no, no. Yeah. You know how to shoot a bow and arrow? No, no. Awesome. Praise God. That's his army. Now, I put it down at this level to say this. Saul has chosen his special ops guys to go after the chosen king. See what I mean? You got to stop and ask yourself a question. I wonder how that's going to go for him. This could be a short sermon today, but it's not. But it's not going to go well. He's got the chosen soldiers against the chosen king of Israel. I can tell you, God is, you're not going to trump what God Almighty wants to do, and that's to make David king. He just has to drive Saul out of David's heart, the character of Saul. So in verse 3, the scripture takes an interesting, amusing turn. And if you say the Bible is boring, I submit to you, I don't know what Bible you're reading. Because it says in verse 3, and he, Saul, came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave. Remember the caves I showed you? It's okay to talk in church. Or if I ask you to, but okay. So there was a cave, and Saul went into the cave too. Now you're not saying anything. Well, I can't talk about this in church. Yeah, this is why I will never teach the book of Song of Solomon. I mean, it's just things the scripture says sometimes. It's like, okay, I don't know about that. I can read it privately, but you know, he went in there too. Bathroom break, okay? He thought he was all alone. He thought wrong. Out of all those caves, he picks the cave that David and his troops are in. I mean, don't you find this absolutely amusing and ironic? I do. I don't know how you feel about war movies and stuff. I love them. I've always loved them. I like action movies. I don't want to, like, weep within the first few minutes, feel a warm heart. That's just not me. I'm sorry. I'm confessing. I mean, there's got to be some major action going on. I'm like, this movie rocks. But I've always wondered, as I've watched those kind of movies, they never have to take a bathroom break. I'm like, what's up with these people? They're like not human. That's why the Bible is so awesome. Saul the king had to go. Where'd he go? He's the king. He's got to have privacy. All right? Where's he go? Well, he goes into a cave that just happens to be full of enemy soldiers. Talk about the providence of God. How did David's troops respond when they saw Saul come in? Because they could see who he is. It says in verse 4, the man said to David, you got to love this. Behold, this is the day which the Lord said to you, behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand. You shall do to him as it seems good to you. David, golden opportunity. There he is. He's alone. He's not with a bodyguard. His troops aren't around him. You know, he's dropping his robe to go to the bathroom. We've got him in our misery. This is where it gets really interesting. So what does David do? You know the story? So it says that David arose, and what'd he do? Not what you would expect. David arose, and then the story goes in a whole other direction. He cut off the edge of Saul's robe while he's going to the bathroom. So the troops are like, we've got him with his pants down. We totally got him. He can't defend himself. Just go kill him. So David secretly, with great stealth, maneuvers across the rocks in the darkness and everything, and he gets over there, and he, instead of stabbing him or slaying him with, you know, with a swipe of the sword, he decides to, I got to do a little sewing technique. I'm going to grab his royal garment. I'm going to get into it. And, you know, and cut that off and then slither back to his troops. Sorry about the sound effects, but you get what I'm talking about. So I have to submit to you, like, cutting off the robe is like cutting off the kingdom. That's what it's like. It's like tearing apart the kingdom and going, I want to be king. That's what David's kind of doing. So I have a question. So you ready for the question? So if the roles had been reversed, what would have happened? What say you? Who would have been dead? David. Yeah. I mean, if Saul was in the cave and saw David come in there, he's like taking him out, totally taking him out. David looks at the situation and no, I can't do it. I can't do it. But before we jump further into the text, I do have to ask a question that bothered me for years until I actually went to En-Gedi. How in the world did David creep up on him in a cave? I mean, how'd that happen? That sounds like impossible. Well, let me answer the question. In about 3 weeks, I'll come back and answer her. Or do you want the answer right now? Yeah, you want it now. I'll give you two answers to the question, how he crept up on him. Number one, when it said earlier that there were sheepfolds in the area, well, then there were sheep. I mean, goats and sheep. So that what would happen is if you wanted to get your sheep out of the hot sun, you'd find a cave. And you would push them into the cave, and then you'd get a bunch of rocks, because there's tons of rocks, as you saw. And you build a little wall in front of the mouth of the cave that the sheep can't get over, and you let them kind of chill in there for a while. So if you go in, this is what happened, that there were sheep there, and the front of the cave was marked off by stones from a shepherd, and he steps over them to get into the cave to go to the bathroom. Are sheep quiet? See, when I got to this point in my last sermon, the entire audience began to bleat. That other service has some issues, I'm telling you. They just all started bleating. I'm like, this is funny. Not bleeding, bleating. What's it sound like? See? You all know. How about the, so spiritual up here. What does the upper story say? Bleeding? Yeah. So that's going on. Then there's no way that Saul could have heard what was going on, right? Because I've been in this region, there's a cave. He goes into a cave. It's a big cave because it's holy David's men. We don't know if he had 600 with him, but he had a lot of his men with him. He goes into this cave. Inside the cave is a waterfall. I've seen it. It drops from way up above your head. And when you go into this region where you get to the end of the hike, you can look up and you can see stalactites on the ceiling. Those are stalactites, right? And those stalactites, you see them on the ceiling, so you make the logical deduction. What is the difference between a stalactite and a stalagmite? One's coming down, one's going up. Well, that's deep. Yeah, that's true. That another way to theorize, because eventually they form a column if they do it for a long enough time. But the stalactite holds tight to the ceiling. Correct? Yes. Stalagmite, with all its might, holds onto the ground. Now you know. So you see stalactites above your head. You look down and go, wow, there's stalactites on the ground where they don't belong. How'd they get there? Earthquake. Caused the entire cavern to implode. And you're standing in what used to be a cave with this massive waterfall. I think I have a picture of the waterfall. There it is. And I zoomed in with the telephoto lens to get the hole where the water's coming out of. But you're standing, you know, several stories down below in a pool, by a pool of water. And this water comes crashing out of that hole down in what used to be the cave. So how did David creep up on him? Simple. Sheep are making a whole lot of noise, possibly. And for sure, there was a lot of noise coming from the water. He never heard him. This whole situation of David going and cutting off the hem of the garment of the king creates a problem with his troops. Problem starts in verse 5. Came about that afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. And so he said to his men, who are freaking out, far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed. Huh? That's your enemy, man. But he says, no, he's the Lord's anointed. He's still the king. Now, the word anointed, Messiah, sounds a lot like Messiah, and it is, which is the Hebrew version of the Greek version, Christos, Jesus, Jesus, Christos, Christ, Jesus Christ. It is the anointed. So David was anointed, or Saul was anointed by God to be the king, and he's still the king. David's anointed to be the king, but not yet the king. And so David's like, oh, I went down there to kill him. And when I got down there, I'm like, I can't do it. Why? He's the Messiah. He's the anointed one. And it's not my place to step into God and help God out. Oh, his men don't know even how to process things. I think David must have realized two things. Number one, once he got back to his men, he must have realized that no matter how wicked old King Saul was, it was not David's responsibility to end Saul's office so he could step into that office. That was up to God in God's timing. Number two, David must have realized that if he attacks the anointed and becomes the next anointed, what would that situation do with the next person who wants to take out the next anointed person? They could easily justify it. Well, you did it. We'll take you out. And so David withheld out of respect for the office. He didn't do anything. You know, what's missing in our culture? Lots of things. Two big things are missing from our culture: humility and respect for people in authority. Because my father always told me, son, if you don't respect me and your mom, you will not respect a school teacher. You will not respect a police officer. You will not respect, he just went down the list. Was he right? Yeah. What do you say in our culture? No respect. And God says, whether it's a Saul type or not, respect the office, respect that person. David's like, I will respect him. So David says he deals with his men who are thinking, you should have seized the moment. And David says, I couldn't because he's anointed. And then in verse 7, it says David persuaded his men with these words. He did not allow them, because they wanted to kill Saul. He did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And so what happened? Well, Saul arose didn't know what was going on, left the cave and went on his way. They just missed their opportunity to solve their problem. But it says David persuaded his men in the New American Standard Version. That's not really the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is a little more powerful. The Hebrew word shisha means to tear something utterly to pieces. Just rip it to shreds. So if you apply that literal usage of the word in this figurative way to an argument, what kind of argument did they have? A knockdown, drag out fight at the back of the cave. What do you mean you didn't hit him with your sword? I could do it. He's anointed. Come on, man. He was right there. No, it's insane. I mean, you see what I mean? They have suspicion. Who won the argument? David did. Why? His men respected him. They respected him. And so nobody touched him. You know, years ago, I had as I've run into Saul before, you've probably run into Saul in your lifetime. It's never pleasant. I ran into Saul. He was a man who was very, very wealthy, very powerful man in the community, a very vindictive man who wanted his way. I called him a troublemaker, like the church dragon. And as my little church grew, so did his power base with people. He caused me much trauma over the years, emotional and otherwise. At one point, as the church got to 185 people, he split the church and took 106 people with him. Painful moment in my pastoral career. He rebooted all the years of work at that little church with his gossipy ways. One day, after years of dealing with this Saul type, somebody in our church that was very trustworthy in the community gave me some information. You might call it intel on him, and said, "You might need to know this." And so they told me what they knew firsthand about this guy out in the community. And I'm like, "Hot dog! I've got him. I can totally shut his mouth. I can totally address him. I'm in the cave, but I can totally take him out with this information. He'll never bother me again." And then I had to think about it, because God starts working on you, right? So Hebrews 10:30 came to my mind. "For we know him who said," Jesus, "vengeance is mine, I will repay." And I'm like, serious? I can't do it. Why? My motive would be wrong. So I'm like, "Lord, you deal with him. I will not deal with him." So every time I watched him trashing me, I was looking at him thinking to myself, "Wow, you Pharisee, but the Lord will deal with you." And the Lord eventually did deal with him. I've been down that road, and I tell you this story not to extol myself, but to tell you, I understand the emotional trauma of a Saul type. What are you going to do? Are you going to show them mercy or not? David showed mercy to a person who didn't demand mercy. His actions go way beyond that to what I call the presentation. It says, afterward, David arose and went out of the cave. He what? He got up and exited the cave. Huh? And he called after him? Is he insane? He has 3,000 troops. You have 600. I mean, you're at a disadvantage in a cave, in a gorge. Where are you going to go? And he said, notice how he speaks to Saul. What's he call him? My Lord, the King. Now, in your humanness, if you're him, you could probably think of a whole lot of names to call Saul. Why are you laughing? Because you already know what you would call him. Hey, loser. Hello, I got the edge of your robe here. Could have totally taken you out. No, he didn't do that. He called him, my Lord, the King. Wow. And when Saul looked behind him, because it freaked him out, somebody was behind him in the gorge, he did something else. He did, what did he do next? These are things you underline in your Bible. He then bowed to show subservience. And that wasn't all of it. He didn't just, "Hey, what's up?" He didn't do that. What's the next thing he did? What's that mean? He's flat out on some rock somewhere. He just lays down to show total subservience to the King. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Do you learn from this? You should. When you're dealing with your Saul type, how should you respond to them? Respectful language. Humble, obedient, respectful behavior. Not nasty behavior. That's what we see here. And then he proceeds to give, as he gets back on his feet, to give a defense of himself. Now, he's done defense with Saul before, and it didn't work. But he's not given up on factual information. So it says in verse 9, David said to Saul, "Hey, Why do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks to harm you? He's like, that's not true. He says, behold, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord had given you to me into my hand in the cave, and some said to kill you. My troops are saying to kill you. But my eye had pity on you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Now, my father, see, indeed, see the edge of your robe, and check out your garment, and look at it. You're missing part of your garment. It's in my hand. He says, for in that I cut off the edge of your robe, I did not kill you. Know and perceive, translated, use your brain to connect the dots, that there's no evil or rebellion in my hands, despite what everybody in your world has told you. I've not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it. I'm not after you. Your worldview is all messed up, man. I support you as the king. Amazing. He gives an airtight argument. When you're dealing with the Saul type, even if the facts that you present to them don't seem to register with them, don't give up on the facts. David didn't. He says in verse 12, may the Lord judge between me and you, or you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. I will show you mercy. I will not oppose you. But he says, may the Lord judge between us. I have absolutely been here emotionally before. When you're dealing with the Saul type, you get to the point where God, you know, as my witness, you're just going to have to sort through this on judgment day. But where I'm coming from, I know I'm right. My heart is clean. My conscience is clean. That's a great place to be. David knew that God would one day judge each person. So he said, I just leave it to God. David backed up his statement by quoting an ancient proverb in Israel. Here's the proverb. He says, as the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. So he says, a wicked person does wicked things. He said, you're not going to find that coming from me. I'm not going to act in a wicked way. Verse 14, he then tells him, after whom has the king of Israel come out? I'm like, what are you doing as the king? Who are you pursuing? David said, I'm nothing more than like, I'm like a dead dog. I mean, is a dead dog a threat? No, it's dead. He said, I'm like a dead dog. How scary is a flea? Not scary. It's just one single flea. He said, you got this David derangement syndrome in your head that you want to take me out because of absolute jealousy for what God's going to do in my life. And I'm absolutely with you. I'm not against you. And you're not thinking straight, man. You're using all the money, all the might of the military to take out one guy. Insane. And then he says in verse 15, I need to repeat what I said before. The Lord, therefore, do what? Be judge and decide between you and me, and may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. I have absolutely been here before in tough situations like that. God, you know my heart, you know my motives. And I can't convince this person, but on judgment day, I will hold my head high, knowing that when this is revealed, that I will not have to slink off in a corner somewhere. I know I was right. And you just deal with them. And I've lived long enough to see God deal with those people. And in fact, by the way, I've had some of those people when I have flown home over the years back in California, I've had some of them meet with me to apologize, to say they were wrong. It's amazing what God can do. You're coming out after a dead dog and a single flea. Move on, he says. This leads to what I call as the final closing section of the passage, the what? The pulverization. His argument pulverizes Saul's wicked, jealous worldview. It came about that when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, is this your voice? David, is that you? Serious. I'm adding to the text in case you're wondering. Saul then lifted up his voice and then what? Called for his troops? No. He broke down crying. Have you ever been near death before? I have several times. I mean, a wreck where you were almost taken out, but the guy next to you was. I've had that happen several times. I mean, when you're almost in a death situation, and you get delivered, adrenaline kicks in and you start thinking about your life and you get emotional. And I could have died. And I think that's where he's at. He gets emotional. He could have died. And he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have dealt with me well with me, but I've dealt wickedly with you. We would call that a what? Starts with the letter C, confession. He said, David, you are right. I'm wrong. You have declared to me today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered you into me into your hand, yet you didn't kill me? He says, if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go safely? Answer is, no, I would have killed you. That's what he's telling him. And then notice what he says. May the Lord therefore do what? Reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. And behold, I know that you shall surely be the king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. I know that you're the king because you act like a king. How does he act like a king? He has a humble heart. He respects authority. I mean, he's a godly, godly man. And Saul says, I realize now why God chose you and why he took the kingdom away from me. One episode turned Saul around. The only problem was it wasn't forever, because he's going to go back in a couple of chapters right back where he was before. So if you happen to be Saul and have a come to Jesus moment where God gets your attention and you see that you're wrong and you're sinful and you confess it, because that's a deep-seated sin, you might need to be asking God for daily help to not be that man anymore, to be a new man. He was fearful that David would eliminate his entire family line. And so he asked David for a favor. Verse 21, he says, so now swear by me and the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and you will not destroy my name and my father's household. Because that's what they did in the Middle East. One guy replaced another guy. You wiped out his entire family line, so no one was a threat to the throne. He says, will you promise to be merciful to my family when you're the king? David was merciful. Saul's sons were killed by other people other than David, but Jonathan, his son, who should have been the king, he gets killed in a battle at the end of this particular book. But he has a son. You know his name? Mephibosheth. What's his problem? He's crippled. And you're going to read in the future that David goes to Mephibosheth and basically tells Mephibosheth, you are welcome at my regal table any day. I will show mercy to you, and I will not attack you, because I show respect to your grandfather, to your father. I will be a man of my word. That's some kind of man right there. That's some kind of Christian. He showed him mercy, just as he said he was. You have to ask yourself, will I show mercy when God gives me the opportunity? Will I show mercy? What did Jesus say? Matthew 5, 7, his first sermon, Sermon on the Mount, verse 7, chapter 5. Blessed are who? The vengeful. No, blessed are the merciful. Why? They'll receive mercy. Several years after I moved here, I got a phone call one day that threw me into a cave like this. A situation I'm like, serious? I cannot believe the phone call. A lady called me from my last church, and she was best friends with the man I told you about earlier. They were buds. They were the problem for my church, because she attacked me just as much as he did. And she had caused me so much pain and woe. And I was glad to leave and go to another ministry and do other things. And she called me one day. She said, I found you. I'm like, oh no, why? Can't you just leave me alone? She said, I found you and I hear things are going great. Yeah, they're going great, they're wonderful. And I'm the whole time I'm sitting there talking to her, I'm thinking to myself, okay, what do you want? You know, because I know her. And she said, well, my daughter is coming to college out there. I think it was like Georgetown University. She's coming to college, university. And you know her because she was raised in the church, born and raised in that church. I was there 19 years. And she said, she doesn't know anybody. I see where this is going. And she's like, she's not going to have a car. And if she feels alone and if she has issues, would you and Liz call her? Talk to her? Can she call you? Can I have your cell phone number? You know, can I give her your email address? I can tell you what my carnal man thought. What would your carnal man be thinking? Static on the line, didn't hear that, sorry. You know, I'm sitting there listening to her going, serious. And then I start thinking about Christian living. And God's like, no, Marty, you're in a cave. That's Saul. You can show mercy. And I chose mercy. Now, people asked me after the last service, hey, did the girl ever call you? No, she never did. But we at least opened the door, because that's what you're supposed to do. And I don't say this to build myself up or my wife, but to merely say I have emotionally been there before when the unbelievable person contacts you and you're left with a choice, be merciful or not. This passage is great. Here's what it teaches you. I'm going to leave you with this. Showing mercy to the unmerciful does two things. Number one, it reflects the very character of God who is merciful, and that it also reveres him because he's providentially in control of all those situations you're dealing with, because they conform you as you submit to him to the image of Christ.